From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Iran nuclear talks still not settled as deadline looms. Regional repercussions widen from Yemen conflict. Cybersecurity experts meet to discuss ways to keep up with a growing threat. Some new answers to some ancient secrets in the Dead Sea Scrolls. These and other stories coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. There is still no agreement in the Iran nuclear talks with a Tuesday midnight deadline approaching. Negotiators for six world powers and Iran worked late Monday to try to reach an accord to restrain Tehran's nuclear program. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says some difficult issues remain. VOA's Al Pessin reports on what's keeping the two sides apart.
State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf gave the talks just a 50-50 chance of success, saying several issues remain in play as negotiators seek the right balance of terms. But in a phone call with reporters, she disputed a story in Monday's New York Times that said Iran had backed away from a commitment to ship its stockpile of enriched uranium to Russia.
This notion that in the last 24 hours, that somehow there's been a shift in this issue, sort of a hardening of positions, just isn't true.
The Times story was based on a statement by Iran's deputy foreign minister, but Harf said Iran's position has not changed and that negotiators are working on ways to make the enriched uranium unavailable for bomb making, which experts say could include such steps as diluting it and having the supply inspected frequently.
What's important to us is that we can get agreement about the path for them to basically get rid of a large part of their stockpile so that the remaining stockpile, when put together with the number of centrifuges, the type of centrifuges, all of the different parts of the equation, gets us to a year breakout time.
Breakout time is the amount of time it would take Iran to build a nuclear bomb. Currently, international experts put that at just 2 or 3 months. The six nations representing the United Nations Security Council want to extend that to at least a year. Experts say if Iran is allowed to keep the enriched uranium in any form, it will stiffen opposition from some in the U.S. Congress and some U.S. allies in the Middle East. But Aryan Tabatabai of Georgetown University's Security Studies Program in Washington says any deal will face opposition.
There couldn't be a good deal without the uranium being shipped out. Yeah, it could be, depending on what other fixes they find to the other problems. But it would be extremely difficult to sell here. That said, any deal for a number of people would be a bad deal.
Even though the deadline loomed, Monday was a quieter day in the talks, with a lighter schedule of meetings with Iranian officials than in previous days, leaving observers to speculate on what was happening behind the scenes. Several European foreign ministers left the talks, but said they would return if a deal is at hand on Tuesday. U.S. officials have said they expect the talks to go until the last minute Tuesday night, and many observers expect them to go at least a little bit beyond. But Marie Harf says the deadline won't be extended.
March 31st is the deadline. It has to mean something, and the decisions don't get easier after March 31st.
The stakes are high, even though this is another interim step. The goal is to agree on the main points of an accord to guarantee Iran cannot build a nuclear weapon and to lift international sanctions against it. But officials have not even decided what form any agreement will take, written or oral, joint or separate, signed or unsigned. The Iranian foreign minister in particular has expressed concern that any document would become a target for critics, potentially destroying the process. U.S. officials say something will have to be made public, but Tabatabai says it does not have to be much.
There just needs to be something that says to both domestic constituencies, but also U.S. allies elsewhere, that the negotiators are still committed and they have solved some of the issues and they can move forward and they are going to try to address all the details remaining in the next few months.
Skeptics will want more, and those in the U.S. Congress and in the Iranian government will likely get it in secret briefings. But even if the negotiators get some sort of basic agreement, they acknowledge they will still have a lot of work to do to settle all the complex technical details by the end of June. Al Pessin, VOA News, Luzon.
A Western diplomat said there are three major outstanding issues, with the parties yet to agree on how long a pact should last, how quickly the UN and Western economic sanctions against Iran should be lifted, and how they would be reinstated if Iran violated the terms of the deal. VOA's Sharon Bain spoke with some analysts about the sanctions and just how crucial and complicated they are.
The sanctions on Iran have several layers. There are UN sanctions that target Iranian companies, individuals, and entities believed responsible for proliferation or implicated in the acquisition of technology for nuclear or ballistic missile programs. Then there are European Union sanctions, which include an embargo on the purchase of Iranian oil and petrochemicals and all the services related to the transport and delivery of this merchandise, as well as banking and financial restrictions. Finally, the U.S. sanctions, which target those overseas who do business with Iran, shutting off oil sales to Asia and Iran's access to the global financial system. If Tehran agrees to a political deal whereby it stops sensitive nuclear work for at least 10 years and opens itself up to inspection and verification, international sanctions related to its nuclear program would be lifted. Emmanuel Ottolenghi of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies cautions that removing the restrictions will leave the international community with little future leverage.
One has to take into account the possibility that Iran may cheat the agreement. You have to take into account the possibility that you may need instruments for punishment, for retribution, if violations occur, if there is a lack of compliance.
Ottolenghi adds that once sanctions are lifted, it will be a challenge to get them reimposed. Even scaling them back will mean that whatever restrictions remain in place will be applied in a very lax fashion, he says. It's not yet clear what kind of sanctions relief is being discussed by the United States, China, Russia, Britain, France, and Germany, the so-called P5+1, and Iran. Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, says once a deal is struck, it will be relatively simple for the European Union to lift its sanctions. The UN could decide to temporarily lift its sanctions. And in Washington, President Barack Obama could lift those sanctions imposed by executive actions and then every 180 days waive congressionally imposed nuclear-related sanctions. She says lifting sanctions would be very popular in Iran.
Iranians will come out in the streets and celebrate if there is a deal. And they have exerted pressure, even though Iran has a kind of bifurcated political system with very limited democratic participation. Still, the leadership is aware of the sentiments of the people. And I think that they would risk tremendous opposition if they were to sign a deal and then risk having sanctions reimposed by violating it.
There is, however, deep dissent between President Obama and Republican lawmakers over what constitutes a good deal. And some members of Congress may insist on keeping or even intensifying sanctions in order to maintain some sort of leverage over Tehran. Slavin acknowledges that the deal involves a level of risk, but says it is questionable how long such draconian sanctions could last anyway.
So even if there are some in the U.S. Congress that would like to maintain these sanctions indefinitely and would even like to intensify them, they're only effective if most of the rest of the world agrees. So this is kind of the peak moment for the U.S. and its allies to exert pressure on Iran. It's the peak moment to get a deal.
Sanctions imposed on Iran for its alleged support of terrorist activities, money laundering, human rights violations and abuses are not likely to be lifted. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Washington.
A Saudi airstrike killed at least 45 people in a refugee camp in northern Yemen Monday. Humanitarian workers say civilians are among the casualties. Rebel-controlled state-run media say women and children were killed, but Saudi officials say they cannot confirm exactly what happened. The airstrike was apparently targeting a nearby Houthi rebel military installation. Stability in Yemen continues to deteriorate, as VOA's Scott Bob reports.
The offensive by Iran-backed rebels in Yemen has galvanized into action a Saudi-led coalition of 10 primarily Sunni Arab states. Shiite-led Iran denies it is backing the rebels, whose advances led to the creation of an Arab Rapid Intervention Force. An analyst with Tel Aviv's Institute for National Security Studies, Yoel Guzansky, says Arab states would rather the U.S. or European governments take the lead in countering the conflict in Yemen, but in the absence of a response by the world powers, they feel they must act to protect their interests.
Yemen is important not because of Yemen, but because it's another place where Arabs fight Persians, where Sunni fight Shias. It's another pawn on the chessboard of the Middle East.
Analysts say the Arab states are increasingly worried about the conflicts in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen, where groups backed by Iran are gaining strength and where power vacuums are being exploited by Islamist militants. The Saudi ambassador to Washington, Adel al-Jubeir, said the air campaign in Yemen is not a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
We had no choice. We tried every possible way to avoid it. The Yemenis tried every possible way to avoid it.
A specialist on Arab militaries at the same institute, Yiftah Shapir, believes a major upheaval is underway in the Middle East.
The Middle East is not going to be what it was. I don't think anybody can say what it is going to be. We are still in the process, but it is going to be a very different region than the one it was.
Some analysts say the upheaval that began with peaceful pro-democracy demonstrations and evolved into sectarian and ethnic-based conflicts will lead to a redrawing of national borders set by colonial powers a century ago. Analysts say the likelihood of a military victory in Yemen is slim, and the Saudi-led strikes could draw an Iranian response in Yemen or through their allies elsewhere. As a result, they say the best solution would be to bring the Yemeni rivals back to the negotiating table and broker some sort of power-sharing agreement. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
Nigeria's main opposition challenger, Muhammadu Buhari, holds a slight lead over President Goodluck Jonathan in partial returns from the country's presidential election. The country's Electoral Commission announced vote totals Monday from 18 states and the capital, Abuja. Mr. Buhari won 10 states, while President Jonathan took 8 states and the federal capital territory. Some of Mr. Buhari's victories came in states in southern Nigeria, which is generally considered a stronghold for President Jonathan. Another 18 states still have to send results to the counting center in Abuja. Sierra Leone's 3-day lockdown is over. People were told to stay at home across the country while volunteers went door-to-door, educating people on Ebola intervention and encouraging sick people to seek treatment. Nina DeVries has details.
Many officials are referring to this massive shutdown as a zero Ebola campaign. The goal is to stop the spread of the disease, explained Roland Monash from UNICEF, one of the partners in the campaign. It was also involved in a previous shutdown last September when people were also told to stay at home and volunteers moved around, raising awareness.
We don't like to call it a lockdown because a lockdown has a sort of negative connotation on, like, well, we're going around with military, and that's door-to-door to pull people out. That's absolutely not the case. These are social mobilizers. They are really engaging in a positive, constructive way with the community members.
Mary Cargbo was one of those people. She's a nurse and was one of the 25,000 volunteers doing the door-to-door awareness. She hopes this will make a difference in the long run.
Some people up till now, they did the things they did not supposed to do.
Okay.
Because by right, when they said we should not keep any sick people in the house, still some people are keeping them. And if somebody died, they're going to wash the body. Some are still doing it.
The virus is spread through direct contact with bodily fluids, and people washing dead bodies has been a big problem in increasing transmission. Almost 4,000 people have died in Sierra Leone from Ebola. Although cases are decreasing, Freetown is still one of the most affected areas. Hannah Conte was another volunteer involved in the three-day campaign. She said because of the decrease in cases, people became complacent. That's why she's dedicating her time to also spread the word in her own community of Tengba Town, a suburb of Freetown, whenever she has spare time.
We need to let our communities know. We need to let people know that Ebola is real, Ebola is bad, Ebola kills, Ebola hasn't got any cure. You just need to let them know. If you are concerned about your neighbors, your families, I mean your environment, your community.
Manesh from UNICEF agreed and said all the more reason for a second major shutdown.
It's a secondary level of denial. In the beginning, in September, there was a denial that Ebola existed. Now it's more like, well, Ebola is not around anymore. So it's a different type of denial, but it has the same implications because we can't, as I mentioned, relax. We really need to be alert. So it is a challenge, and that's one of the reasons why we're going out there.
Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Guinea has closed its border with Sierra Leone as part of a new effort to stamp out Ebola. Across West Africa, more than 10,000 people have died from Ebola. President Obama is planning to visit his ancestral homeland of Kenya in what would be his first visit there as president. Mr. Obama will go to Kenya at the end of July to attend the Global Entrepreneurship Summit. The White House says the exact dates are not confirmed, and there is no word on whether he plans to see family members while in Kenya. French prosecutors say the German wing's co-pilot, accused of intentionally crashing his plane into the Alps last week, killing all 150 people on board, had suicidal tendencies in the past, but appeared to be stable. French officials say the plane's flight recorders indicate the co-pilot Andreas Lubitz locked the pilot out of the cockpit before deliberately setting the plane on course to slam into the mountainside. Prosecutors say they have not yet found any motive for his action. Authorities are working to build a more sturdy road to facilitate access for forensic experts and family members who want to visit the site. One person was killed and two others wounded Monday after federal police opened fire on an unauthorized car trying to access a U.S. military compound near Washington. The National Security Agency says security officials shot at a vehicle carrying two men dressed as women after the driver accelerated toward a police car guarding the Fort Meade complex where the intelligence agency is headquartered. An occupant of the vehicle died at the scene. Another was transported to a local hospital, as was a police officer with non-life-threatening injuries. Authorities say they do not believe the incident is related to terrorism. A British man pleaded guilty in federal court in New York to charges of trying to set up an al-Qaeda terrorist training camp in rural Oregon in the U.S. Northwest. Haroon Aswad faces up to 20 years in prison when he is sentenced at a later date. Aswad came to the U.S. from Britain in 2009. He and two co-defendants conspired to stockpile weapons and train other Muslims in acts of terrorism at a camp they planned to set up in Oregon.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
All that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
While a bomb attack somewhere provides dramatic images for news reports, every day there are almost invisible activities that could create a much more widespread and devastating calamity. These are cyber intrusions into government and corporate information and control systems that could cripple vital services and bring normal commerce to a halt. To learn more about what's being done to counter such threats, VOA's Greg Flakes visited a cybersecurity conference in Houston, Texas.
When Hurricane Sandy struck the New York City area in 2012, thousands of people were stranded without vital services like electricity and transportation as repair crews struggled to get systems back up and running. Every day, malicious hackers threaten a similar disaster as they probe the computers that control those systems. Concern over such threats, as well as criminal intrusions, brought representatives from government and the private sector together at the Chertoff Group's cybersecurity conference. A particular concern here in Houston is the threat to energy systems. Former U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Michael Chertoff is executive chairman of the sponsoring organization.
Well, so we have found malicious code, malware, on energy systems. Whether that was there to steal information or to do reconnaissance for attacks is more a matter of speculation. Saudi Aramco was attacked, and that's an energy company. It didn't succeed in knocking them offline, but it certainly indicated that energy companies are a target for this.
Chertoff says there will likely be more threats to energy industry control systems by terrorists and some hostile foreign governments. Stuart McClure, CEO of Silence, says his company's software protects clients from most threats. But Silence itself is often a target of sophisticated intrusions.
And the only ones that can do that effectively are very large nation states with big budgets, a lot of people, a lot of eyeballs to take a look at what we've done and try and bypass us.
Experts say that technology offers only part of the solution and that constant vigilance is needed to maintain cybersecurity. Companies provide security training to warn against such common breaches as plugging an unverified USB thumb drive into a network computer. The CEO of cybersecurity firm SS8 Inc., Faisal Lakhani, says the human factor is important because technological solutions tend to be too restrictive.
Our economy and the internet is based on this interconnected model, the ability to communicate broadly, to share ideas. And when you restrict that through a technology solutions, you fundamentally take away that inherent advantage that we've had here in America.
Lakhani says humans in any organization will make mistakes that allow cyber intrusions, and he says companies need to accept that reality and develop methods of identifying and counteracting threats. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Houston.
The manuscripts known as Dead Sea Scrolls were uncovered in the mid-20th century. They are still yielding clues about life and religious beliefs in ancient Israel. An exhibit in Los Angeles shows how modern science is bringing the history of these ancient documents to life. Here's VOA's Michael Sullivan.
The largest exhibit of its kind ever shown outside Israel can be seen at the California Science Center. Visitors learn the story of the scrolls, ancient manuscripts that were hidden in caves in the modern-day West Bank during the first century to safeguard them from advancing Roman troops during a Jewish rebellion. The scrolls were written over hundreds of years and illustrate the diversity of ancient Israel, which was home to various Jewish sects as well as early Christians. Israel's Consul General in Los Angeles, David Siegel, whose office helped bring the exhibit to the city, says the documents include sectarian writings and biblical texts that are important to three faiths.
When that shepherd in 1947 entered that cave and found these parchments, what he discovered were the earliest known manuscripts of the Bible. So they're significant, obviously, to Jews, but they're also significant to Christians and they're significant to Muslims.
The California Science Center's Diane Perloff says scientists have studied the manuscripts using modern techniques, piecing together thousands of parchment and papyrus fragments into hundreds of documents. She says they used different kinds of light to decipher hidden texts and tested the material for dating.
Scientists use multispectral imaging, carbon-14 dating, DNA analysis, and other tools to match up all these individual pieces to the same scroll, to read them.
Exhibit co-curator Risa Lovett Cohn says the dry climate of the region helped preserve the writings, leading to one of the most important archaeological discoveries of recent times.
It was really the unique climatic situation next to the Dead Sea, the humidity, the temperature, the fact that these documents were hidden in caves.
Together with 20 Dead Sea Scrolls on display in the exhibit, visitors can see royal and ritual objects and items from daily life that span 1,200 years. They include a small figure thought to be Asherah, the mother goddess once worshipped throughout the ancient Near East, as well as coins, pottery, and a 3-ton stone from the Western Wall, the only remains of the second Jewish temple that was destroyed by invading Romans in the year 70. The objects show the diversity of cultures, Jewish, Greek, and Roman, that sometimes led to tensions. The ongoing analysis is the work of many experts, says exhibit co-curator Deborah Ben-Ami of the Israeli Antiquities Authority.
We are showing a complete story, coming from the present, going back to the past, to a different time, to a different place, and then understanding all the context and all the importance of this history.
Ben-Ami says many questions are still unsettled, including the identity of the people who hid the scrolls. But scientists and scholars are still working to shed light on these ancient documents. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Last year marked the end of an era in Afghanistan with two historic transitions, a political and a security transition. Despite threats from Taliban insurgents, millions of Afghans voted for a new president, which resulted in the September inauguration of a new unity government, headed by President Ashraf Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah. The transition from the old administration to the new was the first peaceful and democratic transfer of power in Afghanistan's history. And finally, on December 31st, America's combat mission in Afghanistan ended, and Afghan forces took over full responsibility for security across their country. And with that, a new chapter began in U.S.-Afghan relations. In late March, President Barack Obama, Secretary of State John Kerry, and a number of high-level U.S. leaders met with President Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah to work out how the United States can best support Afghanistan as it builds on the progress made over the past decade. And so the United States will continue to provide budgetary support for Afghan security forces and will continue to participate in NATO's Train, Advise, and Assist mission. At President Ghani's request, we will slow down the withdrawal of our armed forces and maintain 9,800 troops through the end of this year. The United States will also continue to support Afghanistan as it works to establish a peace dialogue with the Taliban and ultimately to reintegrate into society those Taliban fighters who break with al-Qaeda, renounce violence, and abide by the Afghan Constitution, including its protections for women and minorities. The United States will continue to support the National Unity Government in its efforts to combat corruption, uphold the rule of law, and strengthen democratic institutions. We will also provide $30 million in support of electoral reform and operations. Through the $800 million New Development Partnership, we will help to maintain and build on the development gains made over the last decade. We will also expand our Fulbright program for Afghan participants by 50% and establish a scholarship program to support women attending universities throughout Afghanistan. Afghanistan's gains, said Secretary Kerry, the blossoming of civil society more generally, are non-negotiable, and they must be made irreversible, as much as any military force, freedom, opportunity, human rights are absolutely essential to maintaining the security of a nation. And they can provide the foundation for a new and an even more ambitious chapter in the friendship between our countries.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.